Deloitte Private serves privately held and family-owned companies and advises them on addressing a range of issues, from growth, talent, and succession to the potential and perils of AI. Connect with us at Deloitte.com/US/private.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Dana Perkins, and you're listening to Switched On, the BNEF podcast. Which countries in the world are doing the best job of building a secure, reliable, and sustainable lithium-ion battery supply chain? As we know, lithium-ion batteries are an important part of the energy transition. They provide everything from flexibility for wind and solar to the batteries that are found in electric vehicles, and so much more. So earlier this year, BNEF released the fourth edition of our Global Lithium-Ion Battery Supply Chain Ranking. We rank the top 30 countries using 46 metrics across 5 categories, and we take into account things like the sourcing of raw materials, battery manufacturing capacity, downstream demand, environmental, social, and governance factors, as well as innovation. So on today's show, we speak with Eli Gomez-Kaluz and Kwesi Mpofu from BNEF's Metals and Mining team. And in addition to the ranking, they get into the last year's collapse of lithium prices, as well as the impact that Indonesia has had on the global nickel market. To access this latest edition of the Global Lithium-Ion Battery Supply Chain Ranking, BNEF subscribers can find it on BNEF.com or at BNEF on the Bloomberg Terminal. Subscribe to the show to receive updates for future episodes and consider giving us a review to help share us with others. But right now, let's jump into our conversation with Eli and Kwesi. Eli, thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me again, Dana.
And Kwesi, good to have you here again, too.
Thank you for having me again, Dana.
So we're here today to talk about the Global Lithium-Ion Battery Supply Chain Ranking, our own version of the Oscars for metal. So the name is on the tin in that we're talking about the supply chains for all of the things that go into batteries, well, the metals specifically. But let's just have a moment for talking about who was in the running, who the nominees were for these Oscars, if you will. How many countries were we reviewing when we set out to make this ranking?
So unlike the Oscars, it wasn't just 6, 7, or 8 nominees. Each year we look at 30 countries and judge their potential to form a secure and reliable and sustainable battery supply chain.
Now, rather than make everybody wait for us to open the envelope, let's just get right into who the winner was. And let me take a guess, because on this show, the last couple of episodes, we've been talking about China dominating the electric vehicles market and the solar module market. So is it China?
No.
No. All right. So who came out on top?
So it's undeniable that China leads the current supply chain, but the purpose of the ranking is to try and understand and see what countries can form supply chains for the future. And with that in mind, Canada actually came out on top. So the difference is with the ranking is that we don't only look at the current, but we look at the future. So we include two categories, ESG credentials and industry innovation and infrastructure. And the inclusion of these help us look to the future because supply chains will need to be more sustainable as we go towards net zero. And also because demand is going to grow very quickly. So do these countries have the supporting sectors in place to be able to support the growth in supply chains?
So let's take a moment on ESG, so environmental, social, and governance factors. What do we mean by that in this context? Because that term gets reapplied to so many things, and we at Bloomberg try and have quite a strict definition. What does ESG mean for us in this specific context?
So in the ranking, we include around 10 ESG metrics that are split between each of the three subsectors. And we look at most of the ESG metrics on the country level. So we look at things like carbon pricing, environmental health of their ecosystems, as well as looking at the control of corruption and government effectiveness within the region. So with the rankings, a lot of what we do focuses on the country in that sense.
Then also, I think one thing I would add, Dana, is that so the methodology overall was developed with the industry. So it's essentially what companies are saying in their boardrooms, what the supply chain industry is discussing. So when we selected the criteria, particularly with respect to ESG, it was really those that the auto companies, as well as the mining companies and governments are talking about that matters to them in order to dominate the supply chain.
Yeah, because we did a previous episode where we were talking about the use of blockchain and verifying mines and some of their social practices that would kind of go into how they treat workers. So there's a wide basket of things, but specifically related to metals and mining here, you brought in 10 important factors for this industry. So going back to the winner of this particular ranking, which isn't necessarily where the majority of the refining capacity is, but where it comes out on top when we're actually considering some of these different things like ESG, what does it take to come out on top? So you've gone through these various areas that went into the ranking, but essentially, where does Canada really excel? Are they across the board, or is there one specific area where really kind of set them over the edge?
So Canada doesn't actually place in first position in across any of the categories that we judge. But what they do really well is that they have a consistent top 10 performance across all of the five key categories, and ensuring that they can perform to a decent and solid level across various different parts of the supply chain has helped them get to first place. This is the fourth edition of the ranking. And what we've seen over the past two is in every single category, they've continuously improved. So it's a combination of the consistency across the categories, but also the continuous improvement that has helped them get to where they are today.
So they're an all-rounder. Well, let's talk a little bit about the different geographic split then, if we will. Among those 30 countries, were they all centered in certain parts of the world, or is this a really global supply chain?
I think it's very global. One of the key things we should highlight is that we picked 30 countries out of over 190 countries. So if you're in this ranking, you're probably already a winner. So, I mean, going back to your Oscars analogy, you probably won an award in one of the five categories that we mentioned if you're in the top 30. In terms of the regional split, we wanted it to be very global. So obviously, you're going to find that in most or pretty much every region around the world. We did include some countries. So there are quite a number of countries in Europe. And for us, a minimum criteria to be part of that top 30 is really to have something going on within one of the criteria that we selected or that we assessed. So Europe would certainly feature quite strongly because they have a lot of battery manufacturing going on. You have North America, where Canada, America, Mexico features quite strongly. You've got South America, where Chile also features in addition to other countries. Then you go to Asia, you've got Japan, the China, and then in the Pacific region, Australia as well. So certainly a global benchmark, but then to be included in that top 30, I think the key criteria is that you need to feature quite strongly in the five areas that we assess, at least one of them.
And so since this is the metals and mining team, can we talk about raw materials and really what's going on there and where it comes out on top? Because a lot of our conversations do tend to focus on Africa as an area that has a lot of raw materials that are necessary for the battery supply chain. How has that region fared when we come to the raw material space specifically?
So actually, in this ranking, Africa was the only region where all the countries that we include in the ranking, in this case, it's Morocco, Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, and South Africa. Africa's the only region where all these countries have improved in the raw materials category. And we're seeing that as there's a renewed interest in energy transition and metals for the energy transition, nations in Africa particularly are trying to harness the potential of their critical minerals reserves. As we've seen other supply chains try to decouple from China, they're turning to Africa to see if they can use some of their critical minerals there as well.
So while we're on the topic of battery metals, let's talk about prices, because that is certainly something our clients on the commodity side are watching closely. And there are two metals that have had on one side a fluctuation and the other side a dip. So let's talk about lithium and nickel. And I know we could spend an entire show talking about each independently. So maybe let's start with lithium. Why the fluctuations and why did the price collapse in 2023?
I think disclaimer, every morning, Dana, the first thing I do is to look at the lithium prices. So certainly you've got me on the right spot. And I think the key thing to understand is there are two factors that drive supply in the market, okay? Obviously, there is the supply and the demand. And for every commodity, if you have more supply than demand, you obviously get price dipping, okay? And what happened in the lithium market is a few years ago, battery became the biggest consumer of lithium, and we saw battery demand grow, which essentially led to an increase in demand for lithium as well. Supply was very late to the game. So you had a lot of demand with very little supply, and we saw prices go from 10,000 to about 80,000 in a matter of 18 months, which is very rare in the commodities market, right? To go times 8 in such a short period. Now, what happened is that once you have a commodity go that high level, two things happen. Everybody now becomes a lithium miner. Even my good old friends in Australia who were exploring for gold decided to go for lithium. And at that price point as well, the second thing that happens is that it becomes very easy to develop new technologies to improve existing processes. So your efficiencies become better, your recoveries become better. So now think about it. My good old friends in Australia, all of them exploring for gold overnight, and technology becoming better to improve recoveries meant that supply really increased significantly within a short period. Now let's go back to the laws of economics. Remember when I said when there's a lot more demand, we feel supply, prices go up? When the reverse happened, prices go down. So that's precisely what happened last year, where the technology improvement in China, where there was a certain type of lithium deposit called lepidolite, historically had not been able to be mined, but then with higher prices, they were able to crack the technology code, and then suddenly China becomes a key producer. With all those new projects, even my home country, Ghana, discovered lithium, and they are on their way to develop it. So that meant that prices came down significantly as a result of a lot more supply coming in at a time where demand was beginning to slow down. That was the story for lithium.
But then you note that companies that were mining other things like gold have actually pivoted their businesses. So has this actually had a knock-on effect for other commodities and driven prices up as companies have actually switched their attention as opposed to adding additional capacity?
I think very minimal, in the sense that most of these companies that we're exploring have not started producing yet. Okay, so their supply had not actually entered the market for it to distort the market if they pivoted away from it. So I think the good news for gold producers as well as other commodity producers is that those were early stage exploration projects that simply pivoted, so their supply never really added onto it. But then what happened with other metals, obviously the impact will be different, but at least within the context of gold explorers pivoting to lithium, there was very minimal effect on gold and other metals.
So after you've checked lithium prices and had your morning coffee, is it on to nickel? And why has nickel been, from a pricing standpoint, a somewhat similar story? So is the reason behind it, is it the same?
Quite similar. So also, you had nickel 10 years ago, prices went quite high, and then technology played a key role. So back to what I said earlier, at high prices, new technologies come online. In this case, laterites, there are two types of nickel deposits. Obviously, you have what we call the sulfide, which historically had been the dominant nickel source. So you go to countries like Russia, Australia, Canada, you find the sulfide, high-grade quality ore, requires less energy to process. And then there had been historically low-grade deposits that nobody really touched because they were quite expensive to mine. Then the Chinese company Shenshan discovered a technology where they could actually convert those laterite ore into what we call nickel pig iron using steel. So overnight, if you look at the last 10 years, Indonesia moved from being an insignificant producer of nickel to the largest within 10 years. Dana, for one reason, improvement in technology that made their deposit viable and economic. But here's what has happened over the last 2 years. Indonesia kept ramping up their production, kept ramping up their supply, and once again, it coincided with a period where demand is slowing down. So prices began to fall. But the good news in Indonesia is that they are producing at a very competitive cost, so they don't feel the burn yet. Whereas everyone else, or most companies around the world, are beginning to feel the impact because prices are actually at a point where it's lower than the cost of production. So we've seen Glencore, BHP, and other major producers in Australia beginning to put their mines into care and maintenance. And when we say care and maintenance, we are not going to produce anymore, but we are just going to maintain those mines simply because prices are lower than the operating costs. But that is not happening in Indonesia.
Is it common for a government to get involved in the supply and demand balance to keep prices or to attempt to make prices more stable?
So you can do that in the oil industry through OPEC. In mining, if you try to influence, obviously the EU has the antitrust laws, so two companies cannot speak to each other. So I've got my colleague here, Eli. If Eli was an independent nickel producer and I was an independent nickel producer, the EU laws, antitrust laws, which enforces competition among companies prevents us to try to moderate supply in order to influence prices. So the simple answer is no. And because governments don't actually produce these metals, they also don't have direct control over how companies operate, because then it goes against the rules of competition. So that's why it's like all of a sudden you see everyone pumping in supply that leads us to a cliff edge in mining, where overnight we wake up and everybody asks what happened, simply because all of us were producing at the same time.
Now, as we're talking about these metals, in light of the rankings that we did that focus more on sustainability, this brings us to one of my favorite terms, so a hybrid word. The green premium together is the greenium. Is there a green premium for essentially those countries at the top of this ranking? Are they selling their products at a higher price because the buyers, well, not all of them, but some are looking more seriously at sustainability metrics?
It's always a hard one, right? So the mining industry is one of the most unique industries in the world, okay? So mining industry has what we call price takers. In most other industries, let's take the phone industry. If Samsung or Apple produces a phone today, they actually decide how much they want to sell it. If Tim Cook came out with a new iPhone, he decides that I'm going to sell this at $1,300 because my cost was whatever plus my margins. In mining, mining companies don't have that luxury. They take whatever price the market decides. So that premium would have to come from the market. And now you need to understand how prices are set. So most prices is either through benchmark or through exchanges. If you look at the current structure of the exchanges where the prices are discovered, there's very little room for them to actually have what we call the word greenium. I'm going to steal that, by the way, Dana. There's very little room for them to actually put on a premium because there's no structure to incentivize prices are set at a macro level, not based on company. Now, the assumption is that companies can decide to go into bilateral agreements, okay? So myself and Ellie can decide that you produce the green nickel for me, I would pay it at an extra dollar because I want to reach my net zero target faster than my competitors. But then the key thing is that you need to understand where the EV industry is. Every EV company is looking at improving its margins to break into profitability by reducing its costs. So at the moment, premium is not something any EV company is willing to put on its costs, given where we want to go with EVs to increase adoption. So green premium, two things I want to end with on this question is that one, it will be difficult in the current structure of the exchanges where prices are discovered for there to be a premium in the market. But then secondly, would companies or auto companies actually be willing to pay for green premiums? That would be hard because all of them are trying to reduce costs in order to improve the margins of their electric vehicle production to maximize their profit.
So perhaps as learning rates improve and electric vehicles become more price competitive with internal combustion engine vehicles, which we are seeing happen, and we do have forecasts that actually think about when that's actually going to be, which is not too far away, then it becomes maybe potentially a bigger factor in the future. And this ranking, maybe it'll go viral.
Precisely. But then there's actually a plot twist, right? One thing I left out is policy. So look at the impact of CBAM as an example. So by CBAM, I mean the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism the European Union introduced. And what that means is that if you're a steel or aluminum importer in the EU and you decide to import from a country whose emissions standard is not equivalent to what you have in the EU, you pay a premium on top of that, right? Or you pay a charge based on where the carbon price is. So similarly, the EU is trying to introduce the battery passport. So what's going to happen is that the EU is hoping to track the emissions profile of auto companies in the EU. So if you don't want to pay that penalty, which is aligned with the carbon price, then the good thing is that you go to the producers that produce the good stuff. And because everybody will be going to the producers that produce a low emission nickel, that is where we think that obviously there might be a potential premium attached to those producers doing it in a low emissions profile. So yes, carrot and stick. I think that once a big stick, particularly from the EU, is enforced, there's a probability that companies would have no option than to offer premiums in order to get access to the low emission stuff.
So now we've entered our let's predict the future part of the podcast, which always seems to come at some point in the show. When it comes to these different, well, nickel and lithium specifically, do we expect 2024 to be a more stable year?
Depends on what world leaders have for coffee in the morning. But then what I've tend to realize is the near-term price movement is mostly based on geopolitics, which is number one. A classic example is Russia is a major producer of nickel. So nickel is actually the only metal that has class. Class in the sense that there are two types of nickel. The class one, which is the high purity stuff used in battery manufacturing. And then the class two, which is used for steel production. So Russia is a key producer of class one. And if America or any other country for that matter decides to impose a sanction on Russia's nickel, that certainly would move the market and unfortunately not make it as stable yet. So I think that's one. But then barring all these sanctions and geopolitical impact, we do think that we expect recovery in the market because we are seeing that companies are increasingly beginning to shut down supply. And then if we go back to the economics 101 that I mentioned, when supply finally is lower than demand, or let me say when demand finally exceeds supply, what you see is that prices begin to recover. So as more companies furlough or put their operations into care and maintenance, if it tips the scale to the point where supply becomes less than demand, we think that prices will recover. But overall, our view is that that recovery would not be significant compared to the drop we saw last year.
So we've spent a lot of time talking about countries, and invariably, this is a really important policy discussion, as you've pointed out, Kwesi. But let's talk a second about the companies involved here. What are some of the bigger companies, and is that actively shifting? Are there new entrants in this market, or is it really the same companies that have kind of always been in the space?
As Kwesi mentioned earlier, we're seeing companies expand into different metals and into new portfolios. But in the terms of lithium, for example, we've seen that there's top five producers standing firm in their position. For example, Albemarle, SQM, Ganfeng in China. But as people are recognizing the potential and opportunity that comes with these energy transition metals, companies from sectors that aren't necessarily in the metal space are getting involved. And a perfect example of that is in the oil and gas space, where we're seeing ExxonMobil planning to produce lithium by 2027. And people are probably thinking, like, why is this happening? How does this actually work in practice? But interestingly, there's actually a lot of synergy between the production of oil from oil fields and the production of lithium from brine. So a lot of the expertise and equipment that is already existingly used in oil and gas can also transfer over to lithium, which is great as we're seeing these companies trying to take advantage of what they have already in place.
Even in the lithium space as well, we've seen battery manufacturers actually also go all the way upstream. So CATL has concessions where they're actually mining lithium. As we speak now, they've taken equity in Congolese cobalt mine. Even one example that would actually surprise you, Daenerys, GM, General Motors, the auto company, has actually gone in to take equity in a mining company. And look, I'm not old, but then I know that the last time an auto company took equity in a mining company was the days of Henry Ford. So simple terms, yes, companies that are actually making entrant and dominating the supply chain is actually evolving, similar to what we are seeing in steel, and there are a whole lot of reasons we can talk about. One other reason why we are seeing that shift in companies coming from different places into the mining industry is the fact that people have realized that there is a probability that there would not be enough for all of them. That's one. Second, people have realized that there's a probability that the good stuff from a sustainable or ESG perspective might not be enough for all of them. So rather than adopt their historical supply chain strategy of just in time, and by just in time, auto companies historically don't want to commit to more than 30 days or 60 days of inventories. We're just going to wait at factory gate and deliver. They realize that, look, if we don't go out there and help these miners or even become miners like Tesla announced a few years ago, that might not be enough for us. So you're absolutely right. The companies in the mix that are dominating the industry are gradually shifting. And I'm quite interested in what that list would look like by 2030. Who knows?
No, and I was going to say, we've seen this early mover approach be so successful on a country level. That's the reason why China dominates the supply chain today. So what these companies are trying to do is replicate that on a more granular level to ensure that they can be the leaders in the market that they want to be.
So we've got a diverse set of companies and a diverse set of countries in this ranking. How do we compare apples to apples? Because this seems like it's a pretty diverse set of things that we're going to have to look at. I mean, how do you do this from a methodology standpoint?
So, Dana, I don't know if you want us to release the BNF secret sauce of comparing apples. But look, I think it's that's a hard part of what we do with these rankings, because obviously you've got other micro level of companies. Even within companies, different mines or different projects have different metrics, right? So I think it's important for us to, first of all, set that benchmark. So we go into details. If you take an example, their emissions. So fortunately, BNF has this really good ClimateScope is an example. ClimateScope is one of our big research pieces we put out every year where we sort of rank countries and the progress they are making in the renewable energy space, whether policy or capacity build. So for us, these are in-house methodologies that we've built that have managed to standardize what countries are doing within the renewable energy space, which sort of makes our life easy because we don't have to reinvent the wheel there. So that's an example. The fact that we have in-house benchmarks we've developed that helps us to compare these countries in other areas as well. It's also important that for us, having that benchmark that all other countries' input aligns with.
Is it a pretty tight race between those 30 countries that we were evaluating, or is there a big gap between Canada and everybody else?
There's a big gap. And what we've seen as the rankings have gone on is countries are starting to form into clusters. So we've seen at the top, the countries that have the clear policy commitments, have the ambitions in place and are actually getting to the implementation stage. We've seen at the bottom, the countries such as Bolivia, DRC and Argentina that have raw materials to a certain extent, but aren't necessarily capitalizing it across the whole supply chain. So they're just sitting within their strength and not developing as much as they could. And then we have the middle ground, which involves a lot of the Southeast Asian countries, actually, such as Indonesia and India, that are trying to make the next step to success. So we've seen Indonesia build their nickel market, but now it's how can they use that nickel market to try and attract manufacturing investment. And that's at the stage they're at the moment, trying to get to the next step in building the supply chain.
Adding what Tueli said, this is a unique ranking where it only get lonely at the top for 1 year because, as Early mentioned, the competition really is rising. Never in my wildest imagination when we started this 4 years ago did I think that Canada would become first down the line, right? So the competition is quite high. If you look at the earlier iterations of the rankings that we did, back then, I remember vividly when we did the first one, the difference between China and the second country was very significant. And then last year, you had, for example, the Inflation Reduction Act. And you can see that instantly it puts America in the game as well. And then the EU came with its Green Deal, and it also helped propel countries like Germany, okay? And then you look at a country, like earlier mentioned, Indonesia, where a few years ago, in nickel class one refinery, China was number one. This year, according to BNF forecast, Indonesia is likely to overtake China in the refinery of nickel sulfate used in batteries. So it's important to realize that I think the key thing is that, yes, you can win today, but then it's very, very difficult with the pace of growth we've seen in countries like Germany, in countries like the United States, and then in countries like Canada. It becomes unpredictable who is going to be first in subsequent editions of the ranking.
So Ellie, you'd mentioned those in the middle of the ranking are potentially striving to raise higher. Maybe they're not looking at this ranking specifically as their aim, but they're certainly looking at their sustainability credentials. And what I want to know is what it's going to take to actually rise in that ranking and which countries are thinking about it and how are they going about it, or maybe even a playbook. I mean, basically, how are countries approaching improving in this ranking?
So what we've seen successful for lots of regions is they've capitalized on their strength to help build out other parts of the supply chain. And we're seeing that approach being used again and again by regions that are striving to improve. So if we take Africa, that's a really good example, because as you mentioned earlier, they're the only region that is improved across the raw materials sector. But actually, in the overall ranking, they still sit pretty low. And we as BNF had the opportunity to visit South Africa for the BNF Forum in Cape Town. And we had a discussion about how we could harness the critical minerals potential in Africa to ensure that this foundation for growth can be made. And what we found is that in Africa, for example, they are established in the mining sector. South Africa's the top producer of mined manganese. DRC takes the largest share of the mined cobalt supply in the world, but it stops at mine supply. And what Africa are trying to do and need to do is actually harness their critical minerals potential to be able to move further downstream in the raw materials value chain. So actually take part in the value adding activity, which can bring more development and economic benefit to the region so that they can build further down the supply chain. There are, of course, challenges to that. And what the report highlighted is that there's been progress, but actually there's a real long way to go for Africa still. And focusing on specific areas is important to ensure that Africa can become a supply chain for the future.
I think Dana, I can talk about some of those specific points that we highlighted in the report in how Africa can improve its critical minerals potential. And one was obviously sustainability. And as you know, at BNF is something that is important to us, but it's not just we at BNF. Also, the wider industry is beginning to look into how can mines be more sustainable. There's one way where if you look at South Africa has one of the highest CO2 emissions on its grid. So that doesn't help really well if Africa wants to be the raw material producer of the future. Another area is also good governance. So there were instances where if you look at a country like the Democratic Republic of Congo, a few years ago, Amnesty International did a report and talked about how there were incidents of corruption and also human rights abuses in the mining value chain, particularly at the artisanal, illegal artisanal small scale level. So that's also one thing where the report highlighted that good governance will certainly go a long way into making Africa the important region to produce the raw materials we need for the transition. Financing was also part of it, right? Because most companies or most countries are not able to transform their mineral resources into value-add products, which would improve their scores on the ranking simply because they are not getting access to financing. And we did touch on the important factors that is needed to ensure that these projects get the much-needed financing. Another important thing is, Dana, one thing that most people don't know is I started my career in a university. So skill set matters a lot to me. And it's important that one of the challenge we put to the people around the roundtable was the fact that how many universities are actually offering a course in battery management or battery engineering or call it whatever, right? So it's important that countries, regions can be passionate about the transition, but without preparing the workforce of the future today, it becomes practically impossible to play any key role in there, and a host of other factors as well. And I believe once African countries, particularly in this ranking, are able to address these, I'm pretty sure that the rankings down the line might look different from what it is today.
Well, Kwesi, Ellie, thank you so much for coming on the show today, sharing the rankings and just some of the really interesting things that are happening in metals and mining at the moment.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Dana.
Switched On is produced by Cam Gray, with production assistance from Kamala Schelling and Lucy Karunaratne. Bloomberg NEF is a service provided by Bloomberg Finance LP and its affiliates. This recording does not constitute, nor should it be construed as investment advice, investment recommendations, or a recommendation as to an investment or other strategy. Bloomberg NEF should not be considered as information sufficient upon which to base an investment decision. Neither Bloomberg Finance LP nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie's based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.